Hello, you've tuned in to the Death Dialogues Project podcast. My name is Becky Odd Jennison, and I'm your host. Why death? Death is the part of our lives we are so very certain about, yet we fear the most. Hiding deep within anxiety, which is a current epidemic, lies the fear of death, ours or a loved one's. But what if I told you that people who embrace death and talk about it openly have a more full-spectrum life experience? We know it isn't your fault. We've been programmed to stuff our conversations and feelings surrounding end of life. By listening to other stories, you get invaluable practice. Our listeners feel more informed about what to do when they find themselves negotiating that inevitable terrain. Most of all, our listeners feel a personal expansion after sitting with someone's tender and fascinating story. That's why we say, listening will make you a better human. Promise. Thanks for being here. Throughout the life of the Death Dialogues Project and podcast, people have encouraged me to seek support, sponsors, grants, Patreon. I haven't because it just didn't resonate for this grassroots effort, and actually being one person, the time involved was just too much. But now I do have an ask for you. We have two books coming out in 2022 based on this work that I believe people will find very helpful, with any of the profits being fed right back into this project. The hope is to reach the people that need to hear these conversations the most. So far, this project has been spread primarily through word of mouth. So I have a favor to ask that will have many benefits for us. Please, if you appreciate this podcast, subscribe and rate it on the platform where you listen to it. And please share with those you think might appreciate or benefit from the content. Secondly, be on the lookout for our books when they arrive in 2022. Initially planned as one book, my publisher advised me to create two books. The first, due out in February, is Death and Its Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Beautiful Lessons, Field Notes from the Death Dialogues Project. And the second is And Then the Stars Spoke, A Memoir Through the Lens of Death. Most of our social media engagement is on Instagram, and we'd love for you to follow our journey there and keep up with the process surrounding the books. Just recently, there was a cover reveal. Thank you so much for your patience and your support and listening to this little wee commercial for our work. Take good care. For those of you that have been around for some time, you know I'm not one to give trigger warnings. That is because the Death Dialogues Project title gives it away. We're going to be talking about death. We're going to be talking about difficult situations. And today we're going to be talking about something that we've talked about before. And that is when a person chooses to end their life. Today's guest is Jennifer Davis. And in great detail, a story that she has yearned to get off her chest and share because she knows what surviving a suicide is like. She knows in her heart what it is to be the last one standing and having to redefine her life. And she firmly believes that sharing the details that she shares with you today will help others who find themselves in similar situations. Because one day that was her looking around for something that she could reach out to that would help her understand the terrain she was in. Today's story is a story we hear all too often when situational losses
stressors, and a lifetime of dealing with underlying issues possibly just becomes one building block stacked on another, emotionally, situationally, too many, and an impulsive decision is made that leaves everyone wanting answers and lacking understanding of how to move forward. You will hear the depths of Jennifer's story and the degree that she feels she understands the man that she was with for 35 years and how this did transpire. And like me, I'm sure you will be in awe at her ability to share as she shares and be as transparent as she is. So I'd like you to take a moment. I'd like you to look through her program notes. That is just the tip of the iceberg. And I want you to be very mindful about going into this episode, because this is real and this is raw. But this is a part of life and a part of death that we talk about much too infrequently. And we are here to be open to sitting with others' very, very difficult stories. Thank you for being here.
Hey, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
We've played a little cat and mouse over the past year or so, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
You are someone I really enjoy connecting with. And I know this is a deep, deep and wide story for you. And yeah. I want you to take care of your heart while you're talking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, only go as far as you want to go.
Sure.
And just as you know, tell us where you're at in the world and just start with your story wherever you feel like it's appropriate. And we'll just chat from there if that's okay with you.
Sounds good. There may be tears, just so you know.
Absolutely.
It's just something that, I always wonder, is there ever going to be a point in time where there's not? And I don't know. I just, not yet anyway, not yet. And it's been almost 4 years. And so I lost my husband almost 4 years ago, May 30th, to suicide. It was not expected by me. There was a huge amount of issues that had happened. He had lost his job, and we moved here to Arizona. Then I lost my job, and then he got arrested, and then he took his life. And so a lot of things happened in 18 months. And looking back, of course, I can see that there was red flags. But while I was in it, I thought it was just something that we would get through. And we didn't. Well, he didn't anyway. And I met him when I was 14 years old. And so he was, I don't want to say we were childhood sweethearts, because we weren't sweethearts when we met, but we met and started, I mean, we started dating, we reconnected and started dating when I was 20. And that, as far as I'm concerned, is a baby. Yeah. I mean, when I think about it now, I think, holy crap, what was I thinking?
But you were all grown up. That's what.
Oh my God. Yeah, I did. And both of us kind of had an impulsive streak. We were like cautiously impulsive, you know. I mean, sometimes, you know, when we got married, we took the plunge and just did it. And but you know, we weren't like risk takers in that sense that we would go skydiving or jump out of planes or things like that. And I think we spent much of our life being cautious. And, you know, I would like to think that I had a happy marriage, and I did for the most part, but there was a lot of not happy. And that's because you have two people that come from two completely different backgrounds and you try to make a home, you know, and that's why they say that there's so many marriage fatalities when you marry young, you know. And my son told me, he says, I think, Mom, you stayed married out of sheer stubbornness. And I said, yeah, that's probably true. I am a stubborn person. And I also took it seriously, my vows, you know, it's like, it's not easy to get divorced for a reason, you know, so you have to work on it. And we had, he had a terrible childhood, and I had not such a great childhood either. And, but the difference is that I could move forward. I forgave my father, who was not a great father, you know, was not a good father. And, 2 weeks before my dad died, I talked to him, told him I loved him. And, he wasn't a good dad. I could admit he wasn't a good dad, but holding on to that anger and hate would not be good for me. And the difference was, is that my husband could not let go of his anger. And if you pointed it out to him, then he would just, he'd get mad about it. So when we had been married, it was prior to our 20th wedding anniversary. He took a job at, am I allowed to say job name or company names?
I don't know. I have not really considered that. Maybe just.
Yeah. I mean, we never signed an NDA or anything like that. I mean, he worked for AT&T, big company.
Yeah.
And I worked for Boeing. And like all big companies, they are amoral when it comes to their people. They really don't care about their people. They, you know, you're a number to them. And that's not to say that everybody at the company is that way or, you know, but Bill was dyslexic and he had a very hard time. He didn't graduate from high school until he was until he was 30. You know, he went back. I encouraged him to complete his diploma. I said, because there's too many with college degrees that don't have jobs, you should, you know, try to finish your high school degree. And he did, but he was dyslexic. And so he had a very difficult time, didn't do well on tests, but he was brilliant, really.
Yep.
So he had gone through a series of jobs, you know, like we all did. And he took the job at AT&T because they were supposed to provide pension. Oh no, that's okay.
Yeah.
They were supposed to provide a pension, and that's why he took the job. He did not like the job and got increasingly more depressed about the job. And then in the end of it, after he died, he died 2 days before his pension was supposed to commence. And they said, well, sorry, you don't get your pension, even though he signed up for it. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah. He signed up for it. We signed a contract and you can't back out of a contract, but it's written in their policy that if you die before commencement date, then you revert to non-retired. So it's like, then you think, but we, you know, he made those arrangements, but it didn't matter, you know, and I tried to fight it, but it was going to cost me way more than the pension was ever worth to, and precedent was that they made the judgment on the side of the company, the way the policy is written. And you have to pass your commencement of the retirement in order to get it. So he worked really hard and he didn't get his pension. And, or I guess in this case, it would be, I didn't get his pension. I get some kind of a survivor fee from them. And, but he was very miserable at that job and his health. He went to the doctor. Every time he went to the doctor gave him a new pill for a different symptom. Instead of, you know, taking care of the symptom, it was a Band-Aid, you know?
No deep exploration.
Yeah. Well, he's a medical doctor. And I remember my doctor saying to me after my husband died, she says, why was he on those medications? She goes, what doctor gave him those? And I told her, you know, Dr. Rosen. And she says, oh, Rosen, he thinks he's a psychiatrist, you know? And it's like, that just frightens me, you know, that, And I do feel that there's this like attitude of just, well, let's just give them pills, you know, and they need to coordinate with a psychiatrist, first of all. And there was never any coordination with a psychiatrist. And he was just on like all these different medications. He had one medication, heart medication, that caused him to, I mean, his personality changed. But it's so subtle. If you're not looking at it, sometimes you don't even know what it is, right? And so when that happened, if a friend of mine hadn't told me that her husband had been on that medication and it changed him, I don't know if I ever would have said anything, you know? Mm-hmm. And so he just took a bunch of series of different medications, and then like his behavior got, you know, worse, but then he also started drinking more. And you're not supposed to drink on those medications, you know, maybe a beer or two, but he was drinking a lot more than that. And, you know, I can only speculate, you know, what was going on in his mind, because I don't know definitively. Only he knew. And when we moved here, after he lost his job, he kept pushing, okay, let's move. And I was grieving because I didn't want to move. And I made it hard on him, and I feel bad about that. And then I lost my job, and I know, because I know him, that he was panicking. And I don't know how long he had been looking at porn on his computer. Do I know that he looked at porn before? Sure, you know, but used to be you had, you know, dirty magazines, right? The internet makes too many gross things available. And I just didn't realize how bad it was. But, you know, there were signs, but all of those signs made sense after his death, you know, not during all the things that we were going through. So when he was arrested because the software he had downloaded child pornography. It was not intentional. He didn't consume child pornography. He never purchased anything. And the lawyer had told me that in all likelihood, he would have been exonerated. But he wasn't able to, I don't know if I could say process, whatever it was. He couldn't, he didn't believe it. You know, he felt abandoned. He thought he was going to have to be labeled as a pedophile the rest of his life, or a sex offender. And he was frightened, and it was ashamed, you know. And when I got him out of jail, you know, they came here and they came here like a SWAT team, you know.
Gosh, yeah.
Yeah. And the day before we had, he and I had this really nice day. You know, we went target shooting, strangely, but it was a, you know, indoor, you know, Groupon thing. And then we went to the movies. We had a really nice day. And I was finally starting to not grieve the loss of my job so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, it still hurt, but, and then 6:30 in the morning, they showed up at my front door and, you know, with guns and it was awful. And I had no idea what was going on. I thought, oh my gosh, Boeing, is it, you know, that's where I worked. Are they doing something to me? You know, what? And then they took him away, and I couldn't find him until, this was like, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday. I could not find him till 2 o'clock in the morning, 1 o'clock in the morning online, because they didn't process him, you know. He has to go see a judge. And so by the time I saw him online and contacted a bail bonds, you know, it was like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning.
So you're saying from 6 a.m. Mm-hmm. till 1 a.m. the next day.
Yes.
You weren't seeing him listed online where you should have been able to. Okay.
Yeah, that's what they told me. They said I would be able to find him online, you know, in the early afternoon. They would, you know, have processed him by then. And they, you know, they didn't. And he did not know how to call me because he had a cell phone, right? And he just pressed my name. He never dialed my number. So he didn't know how to contact me. I didn't know how to, I couldn't contact him. I didn't know where he was. And, you know, I put it, some money into an account for, you know, I put his name in there, put some money into an account. And so he could call me, but he didn't know my number. And he started, when he was in there, he started to write me a postcard. He knew the address, you know, but he didn't know how any of it worked. He'd never been in jail, you know? Right. And the thing that really, I think, bothers me the most is that I always was raised and taught that you are innocent until proven guilty. Mm-hmm. And that was not the case. And I mean, and not only was he arrested, they put all of his arrest details out online. He'd never gone to court, no conviction, nothing. But it's all out there, like he's guilty, you know, so somebody could look it up. And I just, you know, this is a shock for both of us because, you know, we lean more on the more conservative side in the sense that we're, well, you know, we follow the law, we do what we're supposed to do, and, you know, everything will be fine. And it's not true, you know, and that was a big rude awakening, to be honest with you. And how they arrested him, and they lied to the grand jury and said that he said he consumed porn to be able to get the search warrant. And but then when he was arrested, somehow that, you know, that part of it disappeared. And yeah, it was really ugly. I feel like I'm a very naive person in a lot of ways. And I'll tell you a little joke. When Freddie Mercury died of AIDS, you know, he announced he had AIDS on a Friday and he died on a Monday. And I said to Bill, you know, I did not know that he was gay. And he said, Queen, you didn't know he was gay? And I said, no, I didn't know. I didn't know what a queen was. You know, so, I mean, I'm not a stupid woman. It's just that I think naive in some ways. So I didn't know anything about the seedier things because that's just not where my mind went. You know, it's not where my mind went, and maybe I was just willfully ignorant. I don't know. I just, there was no reason for me to know those things. And he told me when I did get him out finally. And so, by the way, he went in on Thursday morning at 6 a.m. I didn't get him back until Saturday at noon. Mm. That's how long it took for the because even though the bond was processed, they don't release them at 5 o'clock, even though in the afternoon, they say they do, but they don't. So he had to spend Thursday night and Friday night in there, and he was terrified. But he told me it made such a huge impact on him because he said all the people that he was with were very kind to him, you know, and they were really, he says, just, he goes, it's not what his image was, right, of people being arrested. And a lot of them were in there because they didn't have money for a lawyer. You know, they were in jail. They weren't in a prison, right? It was just like I mean, he told me that there was a young Hispanic man who just lost it. And these other older Hispanic, they circled around him and sang to him so he wouldn't freak out so much. Mm. And it really impacted him. You know, it just, I think it had the biggest impact on him, and, you know, in his life to that point, other than, you know, maybe the birth of his children, who knows, you know. But, and he told me, he goes, if you want to divorce me, I completely understand. I, you know, he goes, I really fucked up. And I said, I don't know, what part of for better, for worse, don't you get, you know, I'm not going anywhere. And it was like the most intimate talk we had probably in our whole marriage, which is really kind of scary. But I went to a medium after, more than one, but she told me, she says, that was, he was saying goodbye then. You know, she says he knew on some level. And so for 2 months after that, that's when he degenerated, right? Because he went cold turkey off of Wellbutrin. He had gone off the antipsychotics and not in a good way. I mean, better than just cold turkey, but it wasn't long enough, you know? And he was not under the supervision of a doctor because we had moved. And and then he was drinking and drinking and drinking still. And he would be irrational and he would be, but you know, it was all the stuff going on in his mind, you know, all those things. I mean, and like I can say to you, I know this is what he was thinking, but I don't really know, you mm-hmm. know, because I'm not him. I knew him that well that I could guess what he was thinking, but I was always that person for him. You know, I knew where he came from. I knew the things he went through. And I loved him anyway, you know, it didn't matter to me, but at the same time, I didn't always feel like he was there for me. I was there for him, but and he was there for me upon occasion. I don't want to say that he was never, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'm not canonizing him for sure. 'Cause he was not a saint, nor am I. But the, you know, the week up, I don't know, probably the week before he died, I had gone to California for a graduation, a college graduation. And my son was, the youngest who was living with us at this point, he was an advisor training for camp, you know, teen camp. And so we were gone. And while we were gone, he got a letter from Home Depot in the mail because he had applied for a job there. And of course they did a background investigation. And when he had applied, of course he hadn't been arrested. So he didn't put anything on there mm-hmm. about that, but they did a background investigation and everything he was arrested for showed up. Mm. You know? Yeah. And so we were gone. And so he didn't have anybody to talk to. Mm-hmm. And then when we got home, he told me, he says, when you and Leo were gone, I was depressed. He goes, but I'm better now. I feel better now that you're home. And then they wanted to talk to him. You know, they wanted to call him. He said, you know, I don't want to talk to them. I said, just tell them that you're not ready to take a job now and you'll talk to them later, you know. But the woman who called had other ideas and she wanted to know about the victims and, you know, just all the things she said. And it was just like a mental battering for him. And then the lawyer sent us an email and he quit. You know, he said that he had applied for this job and he thought that, you know, he wasn't going to get the job or he wouldn't have taken our case, but then they offered him the job. So he was going to find another lawyer to replace him because he had to. And, you know, they've already turned in the records for a mental health check for Bill. And we might've gotten a better lawyer, you know, in that moment, and he'd had a fight with Liam. It was impulsive, you know. But the day before, he and I had had words because he was drunk at 6:30 in the morning, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was going to do it that day, but he came home and he, you know, I talked him off the ledge. However, I did that, I don't know. But
did he verbalize that he was going to do it that day?
No.
Just in hindsight.
Well, no. And what had happened was the next day, the day he did it, I was going to, Liam and I were supposed to go to Sacramento for a graduation, a high school graduation, my cousin's son. And so Liam and I were supposed to take the cardboard, you know, to recycle, get it recycled. And Bill's truck was left. And I said, can you unlock the bed of the truck? I want to put the cardboard in there. And he said, I thought Liam was going to do that. I said, well, you know, Liam's asleep. I can put the cardboard in there. And he got agitated and loud. And then Liam got up, stomped outside, and then yanked the lid of the truck, the truck bed off and broke it, you know, because he was having a temper tantrum. And, but what the gun, the ammo was in the car, the truck. That's why you want me to have the keys. Mm-hmm. And, so the gun was already loaded probably, which is why I just, you know, I feel like it was impulsive. So Liam broke the truck. I'm trying to find somebody to fix the truck. The lawyer sends the email. And when I'm in the office trying to call or, you know, look people up on the computer, he says, you can't find anybody, can you? He goes, oh, fuck it. And then he goes outside and I heard what I thought was the door slam, but it was probably the gun. And I did not know. There was no knowledge that it was a gun, right?
Mm-hmm.
For me, it didn't sound like a gun. But Liam told me later he was sitting outside because this was in the garage. We have like a shop off the garage in the back and that's where he did it. And Liam was sitting right outside that wall. And he said he heard a crash and he thought that his dad had dropped something. But then later he said it might've been a gun, you know, he didn't know. But mm-hmm. I went out to find him and the door to the workshop was closed and it was never usually closed. And that's when I found him, you know, and screamed, of course. And Liam called 911 and I didn't touch him because I was afraid the police would think I did it.
Yeah.
Because I had heard that happen to somebody else. You know, the husband tried to take the gun out of his wife's hands and they interrogated him for 18 hours.
Yeah, I've heard of those stories as well.
Yeah, but I wanted to hold him.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he looked okay in the sense that he was intact, right? I mean, there was nothing visible other than blood in the front. I didn't see the back of his head. You know, he was like laying down on his workbench. And then of course the 911 operator told, you know, Liam, they wanted him to do CPR on him. And Liam said, Mom, is he dead? And, cause Liam goes, I'm not going in there, you know? Oh. So I don't know if he really he started to walk in, but then he came out. So if he saw him, it was very fast, you know? So, I mean, I had to go back in there and I said, yeah, he's gone. You know, I mean, I didn't put my hand on him.
Yeah.
Cause I was afraid to. And so they came and then they put tape around the house and we couldn't be in our house. You know, they made us sit in the police car in the driveway next door and this creep across the street was recording it with his phone. Trying to record it. And the policeman went over and he stood right in front of him and he couldn't get on his property. The guy was on his property and he said, erase it. So, and he was, you know, he had like tattoos everywhere, he's a big guy. And so as far as I know, they didn't see anything but the police tape and the policeman, you know, mm-hmm. And then I had to call my children, you know, and tell them. And my son was coming back from British Columbia. And of course, I couldn't get a hold of him. I went to voicemail and I had to text his wife and tell him, you know, please tell him to call. It's emergency. And then he told me, Mom, I told you to get rid of the guns after he got arrested. And he goes, I know. It's not your fault. Because I didn't, you know, I literally, Becky, I swear to God, I never in a million years would have thought he would do this.
Yeah.
It just didn't even enter I just didn't. That was nothing I would ever think he would do. Yes, he dealt with depression and yes, he dealt with anxiety. And he was kind of a high stress guy, you know, he was just very high strung, I guess is a better word.
Yeah.
I never ever thought he would kill himself. That was just not, in fact, that was almost everybody's response. Who? Bill? You know? And so then after the nuclear bomb goes off in the family, you have to try to figure out how to make it through, you know? And so I didn't get his pension, and I have my pension, right? I don't have a job. I can't really work. And so we lived off the 401k for, you know, until it was gone. And, you know, like I changed the outside of the house so it would look different. And I tried to make the place where he killed himself not, you know, not a dark place. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. I mean, there was like holes in the outer wall, you know, from the buckshot, because it was a shotgun. And Liam went out there and we had to get somebody to come in and clean it. Mm-hmm. The homeowner's insurance, you can, because I was like, I can't mm-hmm. do that. And I didn't even know anything about that. And they did. And but, you know, they had to take things out and remove it. And there was holes in the outer wall, and Liam spackled them and painted them because he didn't want the other kids to see him. And, you know, he's not even 21 at that point, you know, he's young, and he had to deal with a lot. And he was living here with me. So that made it harder on him, I think. And I kind of feel like the other two, well, you know, Liam's with mom, so we don't have to worry about it too much.
Yeah.
You know, and they have their own journey, right? I can't, you know, theirs is different than mine. And they don't want to talk about him. I mean, my older son now, he does more. He's more spiritually moving in different directions, you know. He's, when my husband was killed himself, he was married to a woman who was not a good person. And she didn't like us. And so he didn't like, you know, he and I had a sort of a falling out for a while. But he's in a much better place now. And he's been reading and doing lots of things, and he's happy. So the other two haven't gotten to that place yet, you know. So, and I'm sure that there's an element of blame on me. And that's okay. I can take it. But it leaves you kind of lonely, you know?
Yeah.
And I started going to therapy right away, and survivors of suicide right away. And then, you know, the pandemic hits.
Yes.
And, you know, you're almost 3 years into it at that point, but it just brings everything back because you're so isolated,
yeah.
You know? And I took a job for a little while as a cafeteria lady. It's not what I'm trained to do, but I thought, you know, if I'm around kids when they're eating, they're joyous. But after about 6 months, it's like, stop spilling the applesauce.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of energy floating around.
Yes. It's not too much.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So, I mean, I literally could not go back to doing what I was doing at Boeing, you know. And I mean, I moved here, and then when I lost my job 6 weeks later, because they can do that in Arizona, you know, there was no misconduct. It was a mistake, but I didn't make the mistake other than I gave a guy a report I shouldn't have probably given him. But their training, they didn't update me on the training. I thought I could give him the report, but, he wasn't supposed to email it to his wife in a Yahoo account with 32,000 records that had social security number and date of birth. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got penalized for it because I gave him the report, and they can do that here in Arizona. In California, they would have had to have given me a warning, or, you know, like a week without pay or 2 weeks or whatever. But in Arizona, they can fire you for, you know, if you have a blue dress on. So, I'm not real happy with the corporate world. I think Yeah. You know, they can kiss my ballon, you know. But the best thing that's happened to me through all this is, you know, all the wonderful people I've met on Instagram, actually, that has saved my bacon, you know, and then wanting to do something, wanting to have a purpose, because your whole life is, I mean, it's gone. You have to start over, really. You know, I'm not a mom. I mean, I am, but not really, you know, they're grown.
Yeah.
And all I ever wanted was to be a mom and a wife. That was it.
Yeah.
And I can't help it if I, you know, am smart and I want to, you know, take classes. Mm-hmm. And aside from that, Boeing paid for my master's degree, which I'm grateful for, but I don't use it. You know, it's a master's in IT, which is ironic considering I couldn't even get the mic to work when we were talking, you know, but, so I've been substitute teaching and that's been interesting. And, you know, but it's like, what do you want to do? What purpose? I mean, what are you going to make out of this, this nuclear wasteland, or, you know, the, in the aftermath of the bomb?
Yes.
And, so do you follow Forced Joy Project?
What's it called?
It's Forced Joy Project, Dana Frost.
I don't think so.
Okay. So she's a widow survivor. Her husband was ill. So he had cancer, I believe. There's a number of them out there that I follow that were caregivers. Right. And then there's the suicide widows, which I obviously resonate with, and anybody who's lost somebody to suicide. But so Dana in Forced Joy Project, one time she sent out these questions to other widows, you know, what would you do if you had a grief registry? And I thought to myself, I mean, this light bulb went off on my, you know, because I'm like, how can I help widows? I want to help, because I didn't have anybody to help me. And you don't know who to turn to half the time. And you certainly don't know how to ask for help. I mean, grieving people don't know how to ask for help. I mean, for the most part, some of them do, and they're more evolved, but I think you're so consumed in a fog of grief, you just don't even know what to do. You know, I mean, barely eat or sleep or, you know, and so what if they did have a place that they could go to, like a grief registry? When I did approach her about that, but she's doing these other things, you know? And so I think that, I mean, I did say something to her about it. And obviously I heard the idea from her. What I wouldn't want to, I would always give her credit for that. But I would like to move with that, really, and do something for, you know, I mean, obviously I want to help widows, you know, but I'm not going to close the door on grieving people, but it's not something that I think that should be mutually exclusive, nor do I think that I should be this big, the head of all this idea I have. It's just an idea. Mm. I mean, I could see it being worldwide, regional, and people in those areas being in charge of it, but then it's like, okay, so how do I do it? You know? And, my son, who's a programmer, my oldest son, well, actually now he's like a technical VP or something like that. I have no idea. He started out as a programmer but he's too busy. He can't do it for me. He says, Mom, there's things to do, but it's like getting started, trying to focus is a challenge, you know? So I have ideas and I do want to help that community, especially, and I've met so many widows who, I mean, they lost their house. They lost, you know, not just their spouse, but their house. They have, you know, because they couldn't fight it. They couldn't, this one woman, she's just said her husband died suddenly and it wasn't in her name. It was in his name, which I thought was weird, but she was the the beneficiary of his will, and the bank wouldn't talk to her. And she just didn't want to fight it. So she walked away from it. You know, lost her house.
Wow.
And I mean, she had a cousin that said, I'll help you get a lawyer, you know, but you just can't really, in the early part of grief, you can't, it's hard to function, you know? I mean, I guess some people do, but I don't know how.
Well, I think you're back to some people have support around them.
Yeah.
That are resources as well. Because I think that's a lot. And I just want to circle back around, Jennifer, and say this scenario that you describe leading up to Bill's death, I mean, I know you had therapy and I know you probably went over this, but I just want to accentuate this for the listening audience as well. I mean, you were carrying so much of your own internal shifting and struggle and pain. And, you know, and I just also, so that was a whole process.
Yeah.
And he was going through his process. And of course, you know, I see this, you know, this dotted line bridge between you. Of course, you were trying to bridge between which other, but you know, you both had to keep yourselves afloat.
Right.
Individually. And then I just want to also comment and say, I really admire, I feel like so many marriages end when, because it gets rough. And you know, we're not programmed as a society, just like we're not programmed, you know, and educated about death and all the ways death may happen and how to be literate in that, like we're trying to do by sharing your story today. But we're also not prepared for partnerships in a way that looks beyond everything being sunshiny and beautiful. Like that's really held up. And as a therapist and seeing couples come in, usually one foot is out the door many times by the time a couple comes in. But I think, you know, we need to help educate our children that it's actually the magic happens with the staying through the hard and the working through the hard. I mean, that's where relationships grow. Somebody, I don't know if it was a I think it was a podcast I heard, but I've heard it before, which is like, I think it was Dax Shepard talking about where he was going to bail on a relationship. And his mom said, well, that's great. You can bail right now. And then you can get into another relationship.
Yeah.
And when it gets to this hard part again, you can bail again. Because until you learn how to work through these things and do what you have to do, which is all individual for all of us and each relationship to grow and meet those things, you know, you will keep running up against that wall and that's feeling like you have to bail. So I just want to commend you that even when Bill gave you permission at a time where many people might have just said, okay, that's enough. You know, I can only do me now. That you were able to have the staying power. And I have to say that means so much, you know?
I know it meant so much to him. I'm not going to cut and run. And I've told my children, you can't be a chicken and be married. You know, you gotta put in the work and I certainly was not perfect. There's a lot of ways I could have been a better wife, I think, you know, and he could have been a better husband, you know.
Always. That's always going to be there, right?
Yeah. But he, I mean, at the end of the day, I loved him, you know.
That's it.
I loved him, but I wouldn't do that again, you know. Not, I mean, I wouldn't cut and run again, but I also know what my worth is through all this. And I did put up with a lot. And I feel like, you know, I'd rather be alone than go through all that again. I mean, I had an invested life with him. I had three children. I had, you know, and I'm not interested in shallow people, you know, so I might be alone and that's okay. That's okay. I think I feel like I have to learn how to be okay with being alone. And I had my person, right? And not that there's not other people out there, but I feel like at least I had that. So I'm grateful that I got to experience that. I didn't really want to experience the last part, but yeah, it's, I mean, and it's, Yeah. And I think you're just shell shocked, right? But I it just never occurred to me to quit. And that could be maybe because I didn't think, I don't know, maybe I didn't think I was good enough to quit. I have no idea, but you know, we went to marriage counseling more than once. I think I joke about this, but I think everybody needs a marriage counselor or a retainer.
I think so too. I think it's the healthy people that proactively marriage or couples counseling or therapy. I mean, I highly recommend it. Yeah. Don't wait till you have a foot out the door.
No. But
I understand what you're saying. Like in hindsight, maybe I totally get that you would have had different expectations, but you know, you were different ages, you know, during that relationship than you are now.
Right.
It still informed you about how to move forward with your life.
Right. Right. And I totally am a huge proponent of therapy. You know, I just am. Yeah. And I mean, I went for myself too. And I have had EMDR and,
Did you find that helpful?
I did. And I'm not done, you know.
You're in the process.
Yeah, I'm still doing it. Because there's so many things you uncover, right? That predate your marriage, you know.
Yeah.
And when both of you come into a relationship and both of you have your own baggage, you know, I mean, all these people that you see, oh, they're a perfect relationship, they're this and this. Nobody is perfect. There's always issues, and whether it's how you work them out, you know.
Yeah.
And because of his dyslexia, it was a big communication issue between the two of us.
Yeah, I understand that. And for him, ongoing stress for him.
Yeah, it was. And he didn't know how. I said, Bill, you have to use your big boy words. I can't fix it if I don't know what's going on. You got to tell me. Don't just get mad at me and stomp out of the house, you know? So yeah, it's just, and there was like so many, when I was doing this, it was like, oh my God, this is such a huge story. And it's so convoluted in so many ways. But at the end of the day, he struggled with anxiety his whole life, which he kept it pretty well under wraps. I didn't realize how bad it had gotten. And I honestly feel that if it hadn't been for all of those medications, he would still be here. You know, I mean, I do think medication has a place, but I think in his case, it wasn't administered properly.
Yeah.
You know? And it rewires your brain. It changes who you are.
And I think you mentioned this idea of him being kind of high strung, and people that are kind of biologically wired, physiologically wired. It's where the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic drive is a bit overactive. That fight flight is equally overactive, and anxiety type symptoms go right along with that. I mean, that's something that most people in that category deal with in one way or another. And then you add, you know, one of the most common symptoms of anxiety is overthinking, worrying, whatever. It could be, if you're a positive energizer bunny, it could be positive, thinking my list to do, whatever. But when the hits the fan and you've got all of this negativity going on and shifting in your world, and then something like the arrest comes that over, you know, probably from what you're saying, and getting, you know, that job response that he got, he's biologically set up, physiologically set up to be overthinking, processing. Mm-hmm. And so that gets exhausting, and that turns into something else for a lot of people, you know, a very acute depressive process.
Yeah. And he, and also going off the medication cold turkey, you know, that,
what did that do to his system?
And the alcohol, you know, so that whole combination, it was, you know, and I know this is overused, but it was just a perfect storm.
Yes.
It just was a perfect storm. And then you go, and then you hear people, oh, it, everything happens for a reason, it's like, oh,
yeah, no,
it's like, what on earth is the reason? And, you know, I mean, so that makes me, you know, that this has just reawakened my whole spiritual search, you know, which, you know, was put on hold for a while because I had children and, you know, things like that. But so I've like, I read Billy Fingers and I, you know, I've just been reading everything I can get my hands on, you know, and gone to mediums, done all kinds of things. And it's, I do have a certain, there's a certain measure of peace about it sometimes, yeah. You know what I mean? It's not always, but sometimes, you know, and I don't, I'm not going to hide this story. I just refuse to. And there is some part of you that goes, oh, I got it. You know, I don't want people to think. And then the other voice says, who gives what they think?
It's the real yeah. lives. And yeah. it's that hiding and the suppression of it that yep. keeps these types of stories repeating.
Right.
Especially, you know, I think with men statistically.
Oh, yeah.
Responsive. Yeah. Ending their lives to a devastating happening, financial ruin, you know, yeah. something such as Bill's situation. Mm-hmm. And unless we talk about these kind of happenings, you know, it's the roadmap back. Okay, yeah. I can mm-hmm. kind of see it. And who we hope might be listening is somebody that could say to their person, listen to this. I want you to be aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, if I can help anybody, that would be awesome, you know? Yes. So, yeah.
Oh, well, we could talk so much Correct. More. I have so many more questions that I could ask you about this process, but what I'm hearing is an opening in yourself where it sounds like what you're saying is that you're opening up not only to your own, who am I right now? Who do I want to be as I walk forward in life? But also mm-hmm. that connection to the other side, the divine, yeah. however you want to call it, spirit.
Yeah. yeah.
As you move forward, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm not fundamentally religious at all. You know, I've always been, I was raised in like a new agey kind of, you know, religion.
Yeah.
You could call it that, you know, a philosophy, really, you could apply it anywhere. And
yeah.
And that's where we met him and I at a teen camp for, they used to be called the Church of Religious Science. Now they're called Centers for Spiritual Living, I guess. And he had his very early roots in fundamental, you know, Assembly of God or something like that, you know, really religious. And then his dad moved away from it. And that's how he and I met at teen camp, you know, and, but he didn't, I don't think he believed it 100%. You know, I think at his core somewhere, there was like a little Baptist.
Yeah.
I say, and I just, he was really a good man. But he grew up with such a bunch of misogynists and he didn't know how to be anything else. But he battled with it because that wasn't his nature, you know. And his aunt told me I was worried about him when he was a little boy. He was always so worried about everybody being happy. And she says, and you were his rock. And I thought for sure he was going to be fine. I mean, she didn't put pressure on me, right? Mm-hmm. But her and my son both said, Mom, if you hadn't married, he said, if you hadn't married Dad, maybe he would have done this a long time ago.
Absolutely.
You know? So I I'm certainly not a saint, but I tried to yank his butt into a middle-class marriage.
Yeah.
And, you know, Miss Naive, you know, and
we ultimately can't control Mm-mm. others' no. destinies
no
as much
no.
as we want to try and as much as we think love
I know
carry, right
yeah yeah you can't you just can't and it was my story, not his story.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's just sad, and I miss him a lot.
Yeah,
all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to forget him, you know.
I don't think I will, but sometimes I worry I will, you know. But I get up every day and I try to help other people if I can, you know, and make sense of my life, because I just don't know where I fit into the scheme of things anymore. Because what I wanted is gone. And I just have to recreate and be okay with where I'm at. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, and be very gentle with yourself when you're not okay.
Yeah.
That's relevant. That's for all of us. That's part of life as well.
Right. And I so appreciative that there seems to be at least so many of these grievers who are, they're living out loud and they're not hiding their grief, but they're not letting it cripple them either. You know,
but that takes time. You know,
yeah, it does. And it's okay if they do, though. I wouldn't even judge.
Because
I refuse to ever tell somebody to, you know, it's time to get on, move on with your life. You know, it's like, that's for you to decide, you know. And I want to just be able to be there and be supportive. And my kids have their own lives to live. And so I do get a little bit of support in the sense that they periodically check on me.
Beautiful.
And maybe that's good, though. Maybe it's better that they do that as opposed to me being, clingy for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm just really grateful. And thank you for asking me to tell the story. And anytime you have questions, you can ask me anything. I don't care.
Thank you so much. And we'll put your Instagram link in your program notes so people can find you and reach out to you if they also have questions or comments.
Because
I know from talking to people, sometimes the thing that they want more than anything when a certain type of death arises in their life is to speak with someone who's been through it. And it sounds like you're open to being that help if you could be, or if people want to reach out.
Absolutely. And I know Shalini, you know, Shalini live, I can't remember her. She's got two accounts. but her husband died by suicide also. And Chrissy, Letters to John.
Yes.
And they're like really good at reaching out, and they're doing all kinds of good things too. And we all have a grief group together, which we all meet and talk, and which is, I mean, because the three of us have the suicide in common, you know, of our spouses, and that's, that helps, you know, there's a relational thing there, because you understand the suicide part of it, right?
Yeah.
If someone lost their spouse to a bad disease or an accident but a murder, I guess a murder maybe kind of would equate, but do you know what I mean? When there's the similarity, doesn't mean somebody's grief is better, worse, or whatever. It's just, it adds this layer that you have to relate.
Of connection. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That's a better word. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I try to be like them.
Thank you so much. And I'm so glad we've connected throughout
the past
couple years and have had our little chats with each other. And I hope that we can do that again. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, absolutely. I enjoyed it 100%.
You take good care.
Okay, Becky. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us today. We'd love for you to get further connected with our project. You can find the links in the podcast information. You can also find the Death Dialogues Project on Facebook, on Instagram, and at www.deathdialogues.net. Take good care and see you next time.